All right, good afternoon, and welcome once again to session OSP233, Managing the SharePoint Disruption with End-to-End SharePoint Governance. My goal with this session is to try to encapsulate as much as possible the experience that I've had dealing with customers around the world and their challenges with governance, and to lay out a program that you can take back into your organization with a set of tools and ways of communicating about governance that will allow you to successfully implement end-to-end SharePoint governance. A little bit about myself before we begin here. My name is Dan Holm, and I've been an MVP in SharePoint for 5 years and in Active Directory before that. My day job is as the Chief SharePoint Evangelist for AvePoint, the largest ISV in the SharePoint space. And with AvePoint, I have the opportunity to travel around the globe, speak at events like this, and more importantly, interact with some of the most incredible companies on the planet, from small companies to the very largest organizations. And all of them are fighting challenges with governance. It is certainly one of, if not the most challenging aspects of SharePoint. When I'm not traveling the world with AvePoint, I am actually based in Maui, Hawaii. I thought I'd share a little picture of what it looks like probably right now, 6 hours behind, off my deck, and down the road at the beach that I hang out at. And hopefully we'll have an opportunity to welcome some of you to Maui in the future. But I've left Maui now for 2 months because I also act as a consultant, and I am on my way to my favorite job in the world, which is actually tech ed, but immediately thereafter to London to work at the 2012 Olympic Games, where I am the Microsoft Technologies Consultant for NBC. And so I hope you all enjoy the broadcast of the games here in the US. Somewhere behind the scenes, I'll be playing a very, very tiny role, making sure that people are getting their jobs done with SharePoint, among other tools. And last but not least, I'm an author. I've written a number of articles and books. The SharePoint 2010 training kit is still available. There's about three copies left down in the bookstore. And after this session, at 4 o'clock this afternoon, I'll be doing a book signing, so feel free to come on down. O'Reilly has a couple of free copies to give away as well. Most importantly on this slide, my contact information. You will be able to download the slides. Please do stay in touch after this session. My job is to help you succeed with SharePoint, and I can only do that if you reach out to me with your thoughts, your experiences, your suggestions, your tips, and of course, your questions, and I'll do my best to answer those down the road. So, we're here to talk about governance. And governance is, of course, a very, very hot topic in this space. If you were to believe all of the buzz about SharePoint, you would think that it's a new religion of SharePoint. So allow me, if you will, for just a minute to imitate one of those preachers of the gospel of SharePoint, and I promise you this imitation will last only a minute. But, brothers and sisters, before the event, we talked about pain, and some of you admitted that you feel the pain. Who feels the pain? Governance is the cure to that pain. Governance is the path to your SharePoint salvation. In fact, governance is the holy grail of SharePoint. Now, of course, I will lead you on the path to that paradise, but really, seriously, governance is not a new religion. It's not the path to paradise. It's not even a new gospel. Governance has been around for a very, very, very long time. It predates SharePoint. It predates many of the technologies we work with today, and we need to boil that hype down. And in this session, my goal is to make sense of the hype, to give you a set of tools, processes, and ways of communicating about governance that you can take back and be successful in your organization. Now, we're going to try to break governance down into a series of elements that are very granular, that you can assign to specific individuals or teams or skill sets in your organization that allow you to really sort of make the most of it. And this program is what I call the 12 steps. There are four forces of governance and 12 steps that will, you can, if you master each step, will in fact together ensure that you can implement end-to-end governance. And this is what we're going to build towards today. Now, before we do that, let's start at the beginning, and let's make sure we're all on the same page by posing a question: what exactly is governance? If you go out on the interweb, and you go to our favorite definition of all things true, Wikipedia, you'll see a definition something like this. Governance defines people, processes, policies, processes, and technologies that deliver a service. Okay, that's one definition, but believe it or not, governance is a word that predates Wikipedia. In fact, it goes back a long, long way to ancient Greece, where the root of the word really involves how you steer a ship, how you navigate. It is not about the destination, in fact. It is about the process of navigating. And that will become very important when we realize what governance really is in the biggest picture. Now, my definition, since you're in my session, I'll throw that out as well. This is the first definition I'll give you, is that governance defines how business needs are delivered and managed. Now, that's a good wordy definition, but I also am a visual learner. I like to see things in pictures. So let's draw a picture of what governance can be. That can help. What's most important is not SharePoint, it's the business. The business has needs. It has things it wants to achieve. And we throw, in this case, a technology like SharePoint into that business, and SharePoint has the ability to deliver a lot of value. It's an amazing product. If it's implemented well, it can deliver extraordinary amounts of value. But we're all mature enough now to realize that you simply can't roll out SharePoint over the weekend and have it delivering all that value all at once. There has to be some way to communicate to the business what subset of that value we are going to deliver right now. The business needs to know what it can get from that service today. And that is one of the roles of governance. Governance is a layer around the service that, among many other things, helps the business understand the service, helps it understand what it can get from the service. And it also allows the service to get what it needs from the business so that it can translate business needs into technical specifications that allow that value to be delivered. And we'll go into a lot more detail about this. But for example, the service needs money. It needs resources. It needs to be able to get that from the business. In addition, in order to give back the value. In addition, even something really technical, like we're creating a team site. We need to know from the business owner what type of information is going to be on that team site. How long it needs to last, is it subject to compliance and records management. We need to know when we can delete that site so it doesn't just become another bloated file share 2 years from now. So we need to get information in, and governance needs to serve that purpose as well. So governance creates a two-way interface between the service and the business to help translate business needs into the service, into the technical delivery of those needs. So governance has a couple of key purposes, one of which is to set expectations. What functionality are we going to deliver? What's the roadmap? Maybe today we're doing team sites, tomorrow we're doing search, next year we're doing social. What's the roadmap? And what are the service levels? What's the uptime story? What's the performance? What's the backup and recovery story? All those kinds of things. Governance also has to manage change. It has to allow us to take those business needs and translate them into a deliverable service. It needs to define roles and responsibilities of who does what. It needs to identify risks and rewards and costs and benefits. And believe it or not, there's a difference between risk and reward and cost and benefit, and we'll get to that a little bit later as well. And it needs to, very importantly, verify performance. And this is a piece that I'll hit several times that really makes a difference. A lot of organizations don't take the time to verify that they are actually doing what they wanted to achieve, and more importantly, that they haven't overshot their goals as well. So that's what governance is from a sort of visual perspective. I'm going to add one more piece to this picture, and that is the piece that I call management. And there's a very important distinction, a nuance, between governance and management. Management is about how we deploy and configure and administer and support and troubleshoot and monitor our service. That's really what IT does, right? Management is service-focused. It's inwardly focused on the service. Governance, however, is outwardly focused. It's on the business. And there needs to be an interface between those layers in order to truly translate business needs into technical specifications. And one of the reasons I want you to think about the nuanced distinction between governance and management is people talk about them as if there's only one thing. In the SharePoint space specifically, people talk about governance. In almost every other technology, if you were in one of the System Center sessions, they would certainly be talking about management because they understand the difference there, but they don't talk so much about governance. Why? Because System Center kind of does a couple of things. And there's not really a big question as to what System Center is doing. It's high value, but it's pretty straightforward. SharePoint, on the other hand, is much more complex on the governance, on the business side, so the governance layer becomes critical. So with those pieces in place, let's now turn to the main purpose that brought us here today, which is how do we actually establish governance? And as I mentioned earlier on, we're really going to look at four forces that need to be in motion in order to propel your organization forward with governance. And within those four forces, there are 12 steps. So this is, in fact, a 12-step program. It just happens to break down that way. And the first of those steps in any 12-step program, anyone know what that is? Admit you have a problem, exactly. And if you don't, admit you will. And if you don't know you're going to have a problem, ask the person next to you because they'll tell you what the problem is going to be. There's all that pain, and you will have that problem. So before the event, we talked about some of the pain points. And for the people on the recording, we weren't able to capture that. But bottom line is, if you're not feeling the pain yet, you will. And the reason is, governance is critical. Now, it always has been critical, but a lot of us have gotten away without governance in the past because the services we were delivering were pretty straightforward. We could roll out a Windows XP desktop and then sit for a couple of years, a couple more years, and a couple more years before we deployed our Windows 7 desktop. We could deploy Exchange 2003 and someday get around to deploying the next version of Exchange. Those services, those infrastructure and platform services were big jumps. And they therefore had a very different mentality around them. With SharePoint, you can't get away from governance because SharePoint isn't like other services. SharePoint is a platform that delivers a certain set of business value today, and tomorrow they're asking you for something else, and the next day they're asking you for something else. It has very, very business responsive and business focused. And so SharePoint needs to be treated differently. So first, admit you have a problem. Second, align SharePoint with your business strategy. Hopefully, your business has a vision. It knows where it's going. In a lot of organizations, the leadership tells you this is the direction we're going. We're going to globalize. We're going to reduce our workforce and become more efficient. We're going to become more responsive to the market. There's some kind of strategy that's driving your business. And if you don't know what that strategy is, sometimes you have to reverse engineer it. You have to figure out what your business is doing by looking around you and seeing the tactical moves that are being made. If you see your business opening up offices in lots of other places, that tells you one of the strategies is geographic growth. Okay? What does that mean to you? So you have to identify your strategy because governance is much bigger than SharePoint. We're here today to talk about SharePoint governance, but that's just the end of the story. You have to start with business governance. The business has to be steering, there's that Greek word, in the right direction. And within business governance, you have your functions, finance, marketing, engineering, whatever, and IT, and those have to be governed to steer in the same direction that the business is going. And within IT, we have services, and each of those services at least should be governed. And in the case of SharePoint, it becomes brutally painful if they're not. So SharePoint governance is a small subset of a bigger governance picture. And so by identifying your enterprise strategy, you can then align SharePoint with that strategy. And once you've finished aligning that with your strategic platform, you're going to be able to move down that path much more easily. Now, in order to align, what you need to focus on is what business value can SharePoint deliver toward down the road of your strategy. And this usually means that SharePoint needs to be more than just one thing to your company. If SharePoint is only a document share, or only a social platform, or only XYZ, it is rarely going to be the cheapest, easiest platform to implement. Because SharePoint is much more than that. SharePoint is a strategic platform that can deliver multiple sets of value now and in the future of your organization. So it means you have to sit down and do a many projects to one platform mapping. You have to look down the road of your company and say, this is where SharePoint can support us. Now here's an example, a real customer. Your story will obviously be different, but this is the kind of story. We had a customer who right now had to implement a business automation solution, specifically around contract management. They had a burning issue, it was costing them a lot of money, they were losing revenue opportunities, and they had to implement that. Now, obviously, SharePoint is one way you can automate that process, but there's lots of other ways, many of which are cheaper, to be quite honest. But then you look down the road, and you look at the next thing that your business is talking about needing or that you anticipate you're going to need, and many of us, across all industries, are focused on compliance. We know that we're needing to think about records management and making content findable so that if we get sued, we can pull up the audit trail and all those kinds of things. Down the road, we might see that our old ASP.NET intranet is going to really start stressing out pretty soon and needs to be migrated. SharePoint can do that too. And maybe even further down the line, globalization. SharePoint is great for helping a large organization connect people and find expertise. And even further down the big picture that we're all talking about here at TechEd, mobility. Making it possible to really work any place, any time, which means working across platforms, not just Windows, desktops, and laptops, but every other device that we were talking about here at this event, iPads. So when you start looking at the broad strategic play that SharePoint is, all of a sudden the cost story becomes a completely different story. And this is an important thing to get agreement to in your organization, is that SharePoint is a strategic platform. Because one thing that will kill a SharePoint product is if the first project, in this case contract management, has to bear the entire cost of the SharePoint platform. That is the end of a story for many organizations. It just won't work. There has to be commitment from the organization that we're going to do something right now and maybe invest some money that's going to be CapEx money, not expense money anyway, to support this platform as we move forward. So you have to align SharePoint with strategy. As we go through these steps, you'll see slides like these, and these are your takeaway slides. These are the things that you want to take back to your team and make sure that everyone agrees to or has figured out how to achieve. In this case, everyone needs to understand SharePoint's rarely chosen to deliver a single point solution. So you have to define how SharePoint delivers the single point solution today, but supports the strategic direction that the organization is taking for the enterprise. And you have to communicate ROI and ROI. Now, this little note here will permeate throughout this discussion. All of us have heard of ROI, return on investment, which is the value we get from spending the money to do it right. There's another kind of ROI. This is Dan's ROI, which is risk of inaction. What is the cost of not doing it right? And in some cases, that drives decisions much more easily than traditional ROI. If you can go to your legal department and say, if we don't do this right and we get sued, we are not going to be able to give you the information you need. In many organizations, that will loosen up some budget in no time flat. Because you and many of us are responsible for keeping costs down. Someone above us is responsible for covering the company's hindsight and making sure that risk is mitigated. And they will respond to discussion of risk much more than they will respond to, hey, if you give me this much money, I'll provide some value. So you have to communicate both. The final strategic step is to get all the right people together and to master the politics. Now, governance is people, policy, process, and technology, to be sure. This is the people side. You have to think about who is going to be impacted by SharePoint. And this is, of course, everyone. And just to keep us in time, I'm just going to give us the list here. You have to identify your constituencies, the business users, the IT organization that has to support SharePoint, the developers who build solutions, the security, the people who are concerned about security in your organization and what information is available to whom, finance, who's paying for it, HR, because almost every SharePoint implementation ends up supporting or affecting HR in some way. Executives have to understand, if not be a champion of SharePoint. Legal often gets involved, and project management. So you've got everyone in your organization is going to be touched by, affected by, use, or support SharePoint in one way or another. And once you've sort of laid out who you've got in your organization, you then need to really think about the politics. And there's a couple of key questions here. The first of which is, who is driving SharePoint, and why are they driving SharePoint? And this varies in each organization. In some organizations, it's the executive who just came back from Microsoft's customer immersion program and said, wow, if we implement this, we're going to be able to, you know, change the world. Please roll out SharePoint over the weekend, and you know, we'll get all this value. Now, that's a little bit naive, of course, but it's great to have the executive championing you. What if it's finance who's saying, we have got to reduce the cost of these legacy content management systems that cost us seven figures a year for support and that aren't giving us any value when we've already got this thing called SharePoint from our enterprise agreement? Sometimes it's finance. Sometimes it's legal saying we've got to improve compliance. Sometimes it's IT, in a lot of cases it is, saying, God, there's this great platform and we can see the value that this can provide the company. So who is driving SharePoint and why? And then, who is impacted by SharePoint, which is basically everyone else, who's not driving it. And very importantly, understand the dynamics between those who are driving and those who are being impacted. And let me give you a couple of examples. If it is IT saying SharePoint's this great platform, it'll provide a lot of value, IT might be completely correct, but is the end user going to believe that? In many organizations, the last time the end user saw IT was in 2003 when they got their Windows XP desktop. They may not be a big believer that IT really knows how to deliver a lot of value in some organizations. What about an organization that just went through a merger and we all got bought by this other organization, they fired half of our colleagues, and the CEO of the new organization is saying, SharePoint rocks! That CEO, she may be exactly correct, but we're not going to really care. So you really have to understand all of the different dynamics between these groups because, bottom line is, the people who are championing SharePoint may not be the ones who should be championing SharePoint. If IT knows the value but people don't trust IT, get someone else involved. Get the executive involved. Get finance involved. Make them tell people this is going to save money. Get legal involved and say, if we don't do this, we're going to have to fire people because we're going to get sued. Whatever the case is, align the right people to tell the story to the users who are going to be impacted, to the groups who are going to be impacted. And then establish teams and communication channels based on the political realities of your organization. Now, a question I often get is, Dan, where can I get a governance template? There is no such thing. There is no prescription for who needs to be on your governance team and what processes there need to be, because it's up to your organization. I've been in organizations where HR really cares about SharePoint, and they need to be involved in every decision. I've been in other organizations where HR is like, yeah, just let us know if there's something we need to know. That'll be two different governance teams. One involves HR very closely, one just sort of keeps them in the CC loop. Some organizations really need IT involved, legal involved, some don't. So you have to build your people and align based on the realities of your organization, not on some generic prescription. So the strategic steps, getting you going in the right direction from the biggest picture, is to admit you have a problem, align SharePoint with your business strategy, and master the politics. Once you've taken care of the strategic steps, we can move on to the project steps, project management. And as we go into this, some of this is definitely not specific to SharePoint. It's fairly basic. In fact, step number four is identify the business need. You've got to know what it is you're trying to achieve. Now, some people will call this defining the requirements, but I think this comes before defining requirements. This comes from identifying an opportunity that then becomes a project where you define requirements. So to identify business need, there are a couple of questions that you need to ask. Just one second here. There's a couple of questions you need to ask. First, and very importantly, what are we trying to achieve? That defines your outcomes. What is it you're trying to do and to get accomplished? Then, why does it matter? That defines your business value. Who does it matter to? That's the politics. And very importantly, how will we know it worked if we do this? What are the metrics around this thing? You need to be able to define those very broad components of your need before you launch a project, before you decide something is really even worth doing. Now, each of these steps that we're talking about in this session can be assigned to certain people, if you want to think about it as your governance team or governance project. This really doesn't have to be IT. In fact, it shouldn't be. This is the business. This is really the business. This is the business owner, maybe in coordination with a business analyst, but this is really the business doing this thing, identifying the need. Now, once we've identified that something can be achieved for the business, we have to, of course, manage the project. And project management is not new. We could talk for days about project management. There's lots of models of project management, including Six Sigma and the Microsoft frameworks. All those models have certain things in common, and I'm going to boil them down into my model, into Dan's model, which I call a discipline of D's. So this starts with defining your problem. And this is basically taking the business need and bringing it in and defining it as a project. This is your project definition, the outcomes, the business value, the politics, and the metrics. And once you've defined those things, you begin to design a solution. And each decision you make in design needs to be based on the requirements in the previous step. And in a moment, we're going to go into lots of detail, because that's where the biggest potential problem lies, is in that transition between definition and design. We'll come back, though. Well, after you've designed a solution, hand it off to developers to start building it. And of course, once they've built it, you can deploy the solution, get it out into your business population, and finally delegate it to operations. In other words, throw it over the wall, which in many companies, larger companies, is literally tossing it to another organization, maybe even an outsourced organization. But that is the basic discipline of D's of building a project. Nothing completely rocket science here. Now, within the development step, you have an option, and of course many of us will know about this, of building in iterations, of validating things in little steps, so that you're not just deploying one giant final solution, but that you've actually taken little steps along the way to make sure you were heading in the right direction and achieving what you set out to achieve. So within the development step, there is another cycle that I call the discipline of R's. So you have the discipline of D's and the discipline of R's, and the R's are, you build a little bit of code and you release it. You then refine your requirements. People say, this isn't quite what I meant. I think we need this over here. Now that I've seen it, I understand better what I really asked for in the first place. So there's a little bit of refining going on. Then you revisit the design based on the refined requirements, and then you revise the solution, and then you repeat. So you go around in this little agile scrum, whatever you want to call it, development life cycle in the middle there. Now, one of the key points here is that the Ds, which are the project life cycle, and the Rs, that are the development life cycle, are two very different beasts. And people in your organization must understand the difference. And if they don't, you will have pain. This is that pain point that we talked about earlier of they keep adding requirements. That is a sure sign that people don't understand the difference between what is a project and what is a development life cycle, a development cycle. So the challenge comes is when you're going around the little cycle of validating that you are hitting the original project's requirements. Let's say you're deciding to create a collaboration site for HR. All of a sudden, they're like, we should also update the extranet and create a job site and where people can come. And all this whole new project comes into that little life cycle. And it really should have been something that was held off until we finished what we really set out to do. And then we can come back and do it again. And it's so critical that your team can draw the line between what is a valid, refined requirement and what is a new project. And the definition really, or the line you have to draw is up to the project manager to say, look, we will not be able to get this done in time if we add this one new thing. And I've been in organizations where their beta for SharePoint 2010 went through that. And I've had a couple of organizations that have more than 10,000 users on their beta. That is frightening because the beta is not on production infrastructure. If the beta goes down, they're going to lose lots of money because now production workloads are on the beta system. And that is a really painful thing to see. So really help your organization understand the difference between these two things. This is disciplined project management. It is not specific to SharePoint in any way. Now within that project lifecycle, there comes the step of architecting the solution, of taking the requirements, the definition of the problem, and turning them into an architectural specification. This is SharePoint specific. And this is the most technical part of the presentation, and this is the part where many organizations really fall flat. They can have great project management, but if this part isn't strong, they can have challenges. First, let me pose some questions here. I want to find out if you think these are crazy architectures or not. And these are architectures I've actually seen in production. We run SharePoint on a single server with SQL running on the same box. We have 200 farms. We allow self-service site creation. Now, people are laughing because, these things do sound crazy. But the point here is these were very valid architectures. It's not the architecture itself that is or is not a best practice. The best practice is, does it meet your requirements? Single server farm was to support a single department in a remote site with 10 users. Perfectly fine. The 200 farms was a Department of Foreign Affairs for a national government that had farms in each of its embassies in order to provide for disconnected access to data in case of a natural or civil disaster. So if it meets the requirements, it's not a crazy architecture. So you have to be able to take your requirements and define and get to a design that's right for you. There is no best practice architecture, but there is a way to get to what is a best practice architecture for you. And this is the process. Now, this looks like a crazy slide, and you don't have to worry about memorizing it now. Remember that all the slides are available for download. We're going to build towards this. I'm a big believer in pictures. This is a tool that I use with my customers. I think you can take this and just put it right into play in your organization, but you can also take it and figure out what it means and tweak it and master it for yourself. I want you to use this tool, and I think this is probably going to be the most valuable thing I give you. And when people stop me on the streets, they're like, oh my God, that green and yellow box slide was so valuable. So this will be useful for you. And notice we're going from yellow to green, from project definition to design. So let's see how this goes. And we're going to use a scenario to really help understand what we're doing here. So the scenario we're going to use is that our farm is already in place. We are hosting a collaboration for the marketing organization. They were the first ones who we rolled out onto SharePoint. And now HR is coming to us. And HR is wanting to collaborate around a recruiting. They want to be able to be better in the way they process resumes, for job applicants and turn those into interviews and all that kind of stuff, and of course be compliant with regulations of our nation. So we're going to go through this process here. We've identified the business need. It is to improve productivity around recruiting. So that's the business need. And we're going to go through this, and I'm going to try my darndest not to use the R word, which is requirements. One of my good friends and colleagues, Sue Hanley, finally convinced me and beat it out of me that we cannot use that word. It's not really a valid word. So let's see if I can achieve that. So HR has come to us with a business need. We start a project. We get inputs from the organization. And those inputs can fall into various buckets. And those buckets are, first, the business outcomes. What are we trying to achieve? Then we get functional preferences, which are those kinds of things where they say, we'd like it to look like this. We'd like the page to be this size with a round button that you click four times for it to finish. Functional preferences. Then we get technical considerations. Now, technical considerations are not a user coming to you and saying, I need a site with this many lists and libraries and content types and workflows. That is a design specification. We're not even near that point. A technical specification at this point in the game is usually about interoperability with other technologies. For example, HR wants to use their iPads to review resumes. That is a very valid technical consideration. Or we need remote access for this, or whatever the case may be. It usually involves some kind of broader technology picture. And last but certainly most important, the project constraints. When does it have to get done? How much money do we have to spend? Who's involved? What are their skill sets, our resources? So those are the inputs, the yellow, the project definition. Now, we start putting them through a process. And the process goes through a very critical red step, and it ends up with a design specification on the other side, which is green. In this case, the first step is to do an information classification exercise, which is to look at what types of data are involved with the business outcomes. In this case, it's resumes, job interview appointments, maybe some other thing, contacts, things like that. So we look at each of those and we classify them and we say, what is a resume? What metadata do we need? How do we want to find this later? And we build from that classification our information architecture. Now, information architecture is another term that gets very misused. And I think it can help you a lot to understand what pure information architecture is. And it is really about describing content. It's saying, what is a resume? Metadata. Content types, things like that. Then, with that information exposed, it makes it easier for us to find that content. So information architecture is about content findability as well. Things like search terms, the site map, those kinds of things. And information architecture facilitates information management, which we'll be getting to in just a minute, but it is not the same as information management. Information architecture is about describing content so it's easier to find and manage later. Then we go, and actually, if you keep information architecture pure, this part of the exercise becomes really kind of easy, actually. Then we get to information management. We take those classes of information down to the information management step, which is where we define things like security. Who can get to these resumes? Obviously, they contain privacy-related information, so we need to keep them very secure. And how do we know that we need to keep them secure? Well, we get that from our information management standards. Our organization says a resume must only be accessible by the individual who submitted it and clear to people on the HR department. That's an information management standard from our organization. We take that in. We say we're working with resumes. There's the intersection. We now know how we have to manage that information. Now, I'm sure everyone in here has really well-defined, sophisticated information management standards, right? Yeah. Yeah, many organizations don't, and I understand that. We should have had them for file shares because the exact same standards should have driven how we set up our file shares, but we didn't. So how do you get them? Well, you go find them if they exist. If not, you get someone who is authoritative, who cares about security and has the right role in your organization to say, and you go to them and say, hey, I'm working with resumes and this solution I'm building, should they be managed? And they'll tell you, and you document what they told you and who told you and when. And if there isn't someone who can tell you that in your organization, make it up. Say, this is what I've decided, document it so that later on, if you find out you're wrong, you can go change it. But make up the standards as you go. You have to do it. You have to have the standards. So make them up and document them as you go through this process. Another thing that is a part of information management is compliance, records management. Resumes in many countries need to be maintained for 7 years. That's actually driven by government-level requirements. So know what your compliance issues are, both externally and internally. A lot of times legal will be your input there. That, again, is an information management standard that can come from legal. So we're taking the intersection of what our company says information needs to be, regardless of what technology it's in. Doesn't matter whether it's in SharePoint or in a file share, it has to last 7 years. And we're applying those standards to this particular project and defining our information management policies for this solution. Couple of other things we need to think about, lifecycle management. So this is the kind of thing that AIM, the American Institute of Information Management, defines, which is how do we get the information in, how do we store it, how do we deliver it to users who are able to see it, that's security is involved with that, how do we preserve the information, that's records management, and very importantly, how do we delete it and when? What's the process? I don't want to be coming back here in 5 years to the 25th anniversary of TechEd and having you ask me why your SharePoint site is so bloated and how to get rid of information. You need to make that decision before you get the information in, preferably. There's a great white paper. The link is on the slide. Download it. It's a nice white paper that covers this sort of information management stuff. So now we've got our information management, which is how do we secure and preserve the information. It has to be sitting on a service to actually work. And so now we have to define our service management policies. What's the uptime? This is an important process for our organization, but it's not that important. So we can survive with 95% uptime, or maybe 99. And as you know, as you add more levels of nines, it gets logarithmically more expensive. So we say, okay, this is important, but it's not that critical. A couple days, a couple weekends of downtime is fine. 95% uptime is fine. What about performance? How fast does it need to be? So service management policies cover a broad range of service things, almost independent of the content, like uptime, data protection, integrity, in other words, backup and restore, content recovery, business continuity, which is disaster recovery if a server fails or whatever, performance, storage. All of those kinds of things should be part of your service management policies for this particular solution that you're building. And it's simply a matter of understanding the type of information you're working with, which again, with resumes, if they're going to have to be maintained for 7 years, we have to calculate what our storage requirements are today and in the future. We have to understand how we're going to support that amount of storage based on the information management requirements, so it's coming down. And the inbound technical specifications are important too. If our HR department wants to use iPads to work with these resumes, we may find that SharePoint's out-of-box browser experience with iPads is perfectly fine, but we might find that what we really need is to encrypt that content on the iPads, make it available offline to users, and we might need a third-party tool to help us do that, which means we're going to have to add a new technology into our service, so the service management policy might include the fact that we're going to need to support this iPad app in order to meet their requests. Now that we've got those critical policies defined, we can now build the actual architecture. We can build the number of servers and farms and databases and database servers. We can then build the web apps and site collections and sites and lists and libraries. And we now are able to flesh out that actual architectural design specification. And all these things do interact. Information management policies that deal with records management may, in fact, influence your information architecture. You might need to create some new content types based on what needs to be a record and what isn't. So there's some influence there. We've seen all the other influence arrows on that design. So at this point, we now have an architectural design specification. And so for example, we can say we've taken our existing farm, which right now supports marketing, and we've decided that in order to support this solution, we need to have a unique site collection for HR that we can guarantee is secure and we can manage the site collection administrators group. We need to have it in its own content database because it's going to scale and we're going to use RBS to offload the documents that are the blobs of the resumes. So we architect our solution out. And once we've architected that solution, now we actually build the app. We build the app on top of our information architecture, the service architecture, and the information management architecture, and we say, okay, within the site collection, developers and power users go bananas and create your solution, and they can start meeting their functional specifications of making pages look a certain way and making the button round. So that's the whole process. Now, a couple of key takeaways from this process. First, there is a process. There is a logical way that you can take input in from your organization and translate those business needs into technical specifications. That was that arrow for governance that we saw at the very beginning of the presentation. There is a process. You can use this one, you can modify it, whatever works for you. Secondly, there are several types of specifications in play. And the more your organization understands the differences, the more participation you'll get. There's the solicited specification. Those are the inbound things. Those are the yellow things where someone says, this is what we're trying to achieve, this is what it needs to look like, these are the information management standards, these are the technical considerations, and here's how much money and time we've got. Those are the solicited specifications. Then there are the derived specifications, the things you decide based on the solicited specifications. You should never get in what should be a derived specification. So listen to this. This is the concept that a user should not come to you and say, I need a site collection with this many lists and libraries and content types. That is a design specification. That is derived from, that is a green thing that comes from a yellow thing. Now, I'm not saying that will never happen, and I'm not saying it's not a good thing if a user comes to you and tells you that, because some users actually understand SharePoint enough to be correct. But you have to ask one very important question when they come to you with that, and the question is, why? You need to push them back out to the yellow level and have them tell you what thought process they went through to derive their design specification, because you have to have those yellow boxes. You have to be able to track back your decisions. You have to know what was the input that led to a design specification, who drove it, why it matters. You've got to understand all of those things, and very importantly, how it will be measured. How you're going to know that you succeeded in your original outcome request. So if you've got to have this for every specification because you're going to have to make tough decisions. You're going to have to say to someone, no, we can't do that quite that way because it's going to be too expensive to do it that way. And you need to be able to go back and say, you have a choice to make, which is either we add more money, to do it right, or we don't do it right, we save some money, we assume some risk, but we can't achieve that requirement. Because the most important point of all, this giant diagram is a system. You cannot change one box without changing others. If you've already gone to the green and you've built a design specification for HR, and they come to you and say, oh, we also need an extranet for job postings, okay, they can ask you for that. That goes into business outcomes. But then you're going to have to readjust everything else in order to adjust your design to meet that. And they have to understand there's going to have to be time and resources to make the decision or the design, and it's going to cost more money and take longer to do. So some of those other boxes are going to have to adjust. And if the project manager says, no, we don't have more time, you've got to have it done, we don't have more money, then you've got to go back to the business outcome and say, we can't do what you asked. So you see what I mean? And each of these boxes is usually owned by a certain set of people. The business is driving a lot of the yellow. Project management is very important there at the bottom. IT is doing a lot of the green or the implementation of the green, and architects are in the red in the middle. And they need to talk to each other. They need to know that if they're getting push from one place, they either need to push it downhill or they need to go back and say no. It's a system, and you cannot change one thing without another. If your project manager says, oops, our budget's just been cut, someone is going to have to make a decision. Which requirements are going to cut? So it's all a giant system. Now, the most important and critical SharePoint-specific step in this process is translating the policies to the architecture. This is the tricky part. You have to know SharePoint in order to make the decision. Because if you look through like a mature organization, and I've seen a lot of them where they've sort of been using SharePoint really for a long time, they've gone through the pain, they still feel pain, but they've grown a lot, you start seeing architectures like this. Very distributed, multi-farm, multi-web app, multi-site collection, multi-database, very distributed architectures that they found that they needed to go to in order to meet their business requirements. So is there a best practice architecture? Yes, but notice I say tongue-in-cheek. It has to be based on your requirements, but this actually ends up being where a lot of us would be pushed to were money not an object. How many of you work for organizations for whom money's not an object? I do consulting, did I mention? No, and so you've got to be able to go back and say, we can't do X, Y, or Z because it's going to incur costs that we simply don't have the budget to spend. So let's step through some quick scenarios here. Now, I've got a 90-minute session that goes into this in a lot of detail. I'm going to cram it into like 5 minutes here, and then I'm going to give you a link to a video where you can watch the whole thing and you can share it with your team. So in this section, just get a feeling for the sort of point here of why you go to a distributed architecture. And then go back and with your team and watch the more detailed video. So at this point, we now have this farm. We've got our intranet on SharePoint. Let's say we've rolled out social, we were supporting marketing, and now we've just added HR. So this is our existing state. And someone in the organization comes to us and says, oh, we need to start being able to collaborate with external customers. Okay, if we look through those requirements and we talk to the other teams involved, we might get pushback from network infrastructure saying we don't want anyone coming through our firewall to access information. We need to completely isolate information for compliance purposes. And so it might be expensive to do internally. And we look at Office 365 and go, wow, in its current state, it's a pretty good place to put an extranet. So we architect the extranet solution in a cloud farm on Office 365, perhaps. And then over time, more and more collaboration happens. People start adding funky web parts and workflows and all these other things. And we start realizing, as many organizations do, that it becomes difficult to update your farm to apply patches and service packs and stuff because there's so much going on in your farm that it's hard to test everything correctly. I'm starting to see a lot of pain in organizations who are like, we haven't applied service pack one. We're afraid what it'll break. That's a pretty common scenario. And one way to help that scenario is to start deciding that you're going to have clean farms and dirty farms. And in the clean farms, you'll be able to patch things very easily. And in the dirty farms, yes, it'll be tougher, but maybe that's not so business critical. So a lot of organizations start doing things like creating service farms, where they have a farm that runs the four key services that can then be published and shared by all other farms. And then the content farm is sort of the wild, wild west at this point. And that might work well for us for a while. And then we have another customer come to us, and we need to start adding a line of business application. Line of business apps might be things like CRM, ERP. In this case, let's say it's project management. Project management wants to do project server, which we have a whole track on here at TechEd. They're going to do a lot with it. They want to add custom workflows from third-party vendors. And as we start evaluating everything they're trying to do, one of the things that jumps out to us is that some of these third parties charge per user in the farm. And we have 80,000 users in our intranet farm, only 100 of whom are in project management. I don't want to pay for 80,000 users for 100. So because of that third party, as we start evaluating and going from yellow to green, we realize that we're probably going to save a lot of money by putting that line of business app in its own farm and isolating the cost of that third party solution. Oh, and now that it's its own farm, it's really easy to charge back to the organization that wants that app. Why should IT pay for that? That's a very specific business functional app. So is CRM. So is ERP. So are a lot of business apps. And isolating cost is a really good reason to isolate something into its own farm. We can also give it its own SLAs. We can now ensure that it has more than 95% uptime because we have a farm that's very granular and easy to manage. Life goes on, and we implement that, and we now get to this question of SLAs. And we have finance come to us, and they come to us with something that is super business critical. And I've had this kind of discussion with clients. They say, we need to do X. It cannot go down. It will cost us a lot of money. Can I do it in my existing farm? Almost always the answer is no. You didn't build your existing farm to do something that won't break. Your existing farm is kind of wild, wild west right now. Admit it, walk away from it, and build a business critical farm. Build something that you know is clean, that you can support higher SLAs, isolate it. And again, maybe you charge back to that part of the organization. But a lot of organizations, enterprises, are starting to do clean farms and dirty farms. They're realizing that certain types of collaboration, it's okay to be wild, wild west. Certain types of collaboration need to be locked down. And that's always scoped at least the site collection level, sometimes the web app level, but really, most of it is scoped at the farm level. If you really want to isolate that, Microsoft itself has three different collaboration farms. Let's call it gold, silver, and bronze. In bronze, it's wild, wild west. Gold is really locked down. And if someone wants to do something and it's they want it really fast, and if it's appropriate to put in the bronze farm, they get it really fast. But if it's a business critical thing, it has to go into the gold farm. It requires a little bit more approval and vetting and testing, and it takes more time. But those users don't mind waiting because they understand they're dealing with business critical stuff. It helps in all kinds of scenarios to start having farms at different tiers of service. We go on one more step and we start building lots of functional applications, things like time tracking and vacation requests and issue tracking for the help desk. These little apps that I call them. Apps, I would recommend you highly consider putting them in their own web app, or even better yet, their own farm eventually, but at least their own web app. So apps.contoso.com would have our expense submission, our time tracking, our vacation request. And that's for a couple of reasons. First of all, portability of the dev environment. If you scatter your custom apps in all of your team sites, how do you replicate your giant farm into a dev environment? That's a huge set of content that you need to take into dev. If you have a farm that is all of your custom little apps, really easy and portable, very small usually, pop that into a dev environment, much easier. Also, what about upgrade? When you upgrade to the next version of SharePoint, when you upgrade any technology, you have to make sure that what you've done up to date isn't going to break in the new version. If you have all your apps in your SharePoint 2010 app farm, you don't have to upgrade that. They're already doing what they need to do. They're meeting business requirements. You can focus on upgrading the farms that will benefit from the new features of SharePoint. So lots of reasons to go to a distributed architecture. And again, there is a session that I've got. I have the link on the slides. I did it in Brussels earlier this year, and they recorded it. That goes into all the detail here. But the bottom line is getting from the design inputs to the design outputs is a very, very complicated thing. It involves making very tough decisions, because obviously you're going to have expense. If you were to go to all those farms, which many organizations trend towards, you're going to need lots of servers, lots of licenses, lots of infrastructure. That's going to cost money. Do you have the money in your project? If not, you've got to go back and say, we cannot meet this requirement. We're going to assume some risk. And here is the cost of not doing it correctly, is that risk. And so you're, again, not only talking about the value of doing it right, you're talking about the risk, the cost of not doing it right, the potential risk. So, big step there, the architecture step. It takes a lot of effort and consideration. There's a lot of decisions to make there. And I do definitely encourage you to share, especially with your more technical folks, that longer video. Step seven through this whole project management process, you have to define who's going to do what. You have to define roles and responsibilities. So for each of these steps, who's going to tackle them? You can figure that out based on your organization. And the bottom line, the takeaways here, is that you need to think about who gathers the requirements. That's your business analyst role. Can be a skill set that someone has, can be a dedicated business analyst. Someone needs to be able to talk to the business user and say, what are you trying to achieve? Why does it matter? Who's driving it, and how are we going to measure it? Someone needs to be able to talk technologically, independently to the business. Now, if that person knows SharePoint on the back end, that's certainly helpful, but the discussion should always be technology agnostic, because sometimes SharePoint isn't going to be the right platform, right? A good business analyst is one who comes to me every once in a while with something that I go, oh, we shouldn't do that on SharePoint. Let's do it on XYZ. Who's then going to determine the solution? This is the architect role. And this is the process of going from the yellow to the green boxes. It also involves deciding whether you're going to custom build things or use out-of-box tools. And this role is a really interesting one. And I personally have seen some organizations that have some perfect people in these roles. And these people tend to be really well-versed on what SharePoint can do out-of-box. And when I mean out-of-box, I mean SharePoint plus Microsoft Office, InfoPath, Visio, SharePoint Designer. Plus third-party tools, plus, you know, whatever. So that they can take a look at what you're trying to achieve and say, hey, we can assemble these pieces, and voila, it's done. No custom code, no Visual Studio necessary. What I don't want in this role is a developer who always thinks, okay, what can I do when I open Visual Studio to achieve this? You want to try to build things without a box, if possible. And if not, you need to be able to scope what remains, the customizations, and the cost of those customizations, so you can push them back through the green and yellow boxes and say, it's going to cost us X to do this little extra bit. And my experience is that SharePoint can generally do about 80% of any job. And that last 20%, you need to be able to say, it's going to cost 80% of the budget to do that last 20%. Now, just as an example, I have a colleague who's an MVP as well, who has a consulting business. And when he started it, he told me, Dan, I want my aim with this is to only use out-of-box stuff. for my customers. And he has big customers, 400,000 users is one of them. And I said, wow, that's an interesting business model. Let me know how that goes. So about a year later, I ran into him. I said, okay, so how's it going? How much of a customer's desires, requests, the yellow, how much of that are you actually able to do with out-of-box stuff? And I assumed he would say 80%, because I'm kind of a big believer in the 80-20 rule. His answer, 95%. Whoa! I said, wow, how is that possible? There's no way. And he said, well, you know, there's always things you have to code. There's certain things that just you have to code. And that's a little bit of that. But the real secret to his success was this. He said, we take all of the inputs, the yellow, we boil them down and say SharePoint can do 80% of that out of the box. And we go back to them and say, in order to achieve the remaining 20%, it's going to cost this much time and take this many people and take this long. And all of a sudden, they look at those 20 remaining items and they say, oh, we don't need 15 of those. The customer suddenly becomes actively involved in defining what they really need today versus what they kind of want today versus what they definitely can wait for tomorrow versus what was just a wish list item. The more you actively involve people in that process and giving them inputs to make intelligent decisions with, the more they become an owner of that process as well. And they suddenly say, oh, we don't need those things. We're going to be perfectly happy without them. And voila, you've just achieved 95% of what they want with very low cost. And you can spend a little bit of budget on the remaining 5. So you need to have someone who can do that role, who understands the world and the SharePoint enough to do that. Now, if you're new to SharePoint, you might want to hire a consultant to do that. But hopefully you hire a consultant or an organization that has a goal of knowledge transfer so that whatever you've learned from that process, you can then take internally and build your own understanding and skill set. And over time, your business analyst may actually become good enough with SharePoint to sort of do both of those things. You architect your solution. Someone builds the solution, that's your developer. Someone deploys your solution, that's IT. And someone has to manage the whole project and make sure that it's staying online and in budget and hitting the goals that it needs to hit. So this really is a slide about staffing your project. Business analyst, solutions architect, IT dev, and project manager. You need those skill sets at some level. If you don't have them, acquire them, outsource them, but make sure that you're getting the learning if you do any outsourcing. Make sure you know why those decisions they made were made. Don't just get a design specification from your consulting organization. Those are the green boxes. Ask them why. Drive back to those yellow boxes. So this is the project steps. We've talked through each of those, and now we have something to deploy. We're now going to roll it out into production, and we need to manage the change in our organization. And I'm going to focus on two key pieces here, the technical and the end user. On the technical side, you have to actually deploy the solution. You have to get it out there. And this is really about how you take things from development environments, push them into production. Hopefully you have test farms, staging farms, production farms. And those kinds of things. And I apologize if some of you have heard this bit before, but I've actually had people come up to me at events and say, Dan, we don't have a test farm. My answer, no, you don't have a production farm. That's how you communicate risk. And honestly, I said that exact quote at the SharePoint conference in October. 2 weeks later, someone wrote me and said, Dan, I just got my budget for my test farm. I told them exactly what you told me. Someone understood risk, and I have a test farm now. You've got to have these environments. And once you do, you've got to move things from test into production. And then you've also got to think, what if we need to tweak something that's in production? How do we get it back into test? You've got to have a two-way scenario there. And that includes your applications that you're deploying, your customizations, things like branding and that kind of stuff, even things like custom columns and lists and stuff like that. And then content itself, the actual documents and list items and all of that. How do you move that back and forth? And not only how do you take it at the beginning and push it out, but then how do you do revisions? If you've already got a workflow in production, how do you revise it? If you've already got a list in production, how do you add a custom column? Do you allow a user to go and just do it directly in the UI in production? Or do you make them do it in test first? Probably in production. But what about a new workflow? Well, maybe that needs to be done in a test environment first. You need to answer those questions. And unfortunately, SharePoint does not help a lot, to be completely honest. This is an area where SharePoint's out-of-box tools don't help in every scenario. We all know about SharePoint solution packages, WSPs. Those you can deploy back and forth, you can update. But beyond that, it gets really hard. And you have to develop your own processes, tools, or get third-party solutions, which there are several of. Now, on the user side, you've obviously got to drive change as well. And I like to talk about the user side in sort of two perspectives. One is the initial SharePoint deployment, which I'm sure many of you have already gone through, the initial adoption of SharePoint, and then the how do you deploy each new piece. So we'll talk about both of those. At the high level, with if you're new to SharePoint and you're saying, how are we going to get users to adopt this thing, you've got to consider the big easy wins. You've got to decide what are users crying out for that you can deliver right away. And this often is easy to do. Things like group calendars, things like after a meeting, we decide who's going to do what. We have action items, and the manager wants to push those action items out to their team and know how those are coming back. All those things are so easy with SharePoint and with the integration with Outlook. It's insane. It's beautiful. People love it. And they're like, oh my gosh, it's great. And you have fans. And that's what you want. You want fans of SharePoint. So figure out what you can do that make it easy for your users, or that solve really big pain points for your users. Now, in some cases, you're going to be doing SharePoint for a reason that users don't care about. For example, I have customers who are deploying SharePoint only to save themselves many millions of dollars on their legacy content management and document management systems from other vendors. So finance is driving it. It's a budgetary thing. Are users going to adopt it because they're told that it saves money? No. So even though that's the real reason you're doing it, don't market it that way. Market it. It does group calendars. It does tasks. It allows you to access your documents even when you're not on a Windows system. Whatever your perceived pain is that your users are talking about, make sure that that's what's being hyped, even if behind the scenes you've got another reason. Branding really matters. And so, for example, I've got a customer who's a power utility. Their intranet is called The Wire. It's not called SharePoint. They don't even talk about it as SharePoint. It's like, what are we adding to The Wire? Their social sites, I think, are called Vault or something energetic. Really cool. Branding matters, and it matters for a couple of reasons. First, if it fails, it's not SharePoint's fault. Ah, The Wire project failed. It's not SharePoint failed, and so you never use SharePoint for anything else. So there's a little benefit there. The other thing is, it creates allegiance with the technology. I have a Windows phone. I adore my voice to text. I love that feature. I can now text while I drive safely just by talking. I love it. But I don't love it anywhere near as much as my friends who have iPhones love Siri. Why? Because she has a name and she's funny. She's a person. It creates a human relationship with the technology. That's what you want to try and do wherever you can do it easily in your environment. Create something that's personable and friendly, and branding really can help you do that. So branding can matter both from a project perspective and from an adoption perspective. Now, that's sort of the initial deployment. Then you've got to get all the solutions out. So you're at the deploy stage of your project. During the project, you've got to embed the user in every phase. Users are obviously going to be providing input on what the business need is. They probably should validate appropriate pieces of the design. During the development lifecycle, they'll be looking at the little releases of code and saying, yeah, this is what I meant, or no, now I really understand better what I needed. They should be in every point of this process, not just the deployment stage at the end. So figure out where users need to be. And not just on the technology side, but on the training and communication as well. I'm a trainer by trade, and one of the things I hate is when an organization comes and tells me that they finished developing a solution, they're ready to deploy it. What should our training and communication plan be? I'm like, you're way too late for that. You should be figuring that out during those development life cycles, testing the training and communication, asking the user, does this message make sense? The beta users, does this message make sense? Is it telling you what you want to hear? Is it solving perceived pain? Because that way, you've validated the training and communication within the development lifecycle, so when you get to the deploy step of the project, you know you've hit your mark. You have no doubt that the message is right. So don't wait too long for training and communication. And speaking of training and communication, please, and I hate to say this because I'm a trainer by trade, don't train users on SharePoint. Don't send them to a 5-day class on how to use SharePoint, because you know what? It's not relevant to them. They won't remember it. And I'm talking about the vast majority of users. There'll be a few power users who might, but don't train users to use SharePoint. Instead, evangelize why they're getting a solution. Make them excited about the pain that is going to be solved, and then train them how to meet the requirements of the specific thing you're doing now. So if what you're doing now is automating contract management for your procurement organization, All you need to do is teach them how to, you know, check in those documents and put them through the workflows and then respond to the emails. Don't worry about everything else. Train them on just what you're trying to achieve, because that's what you're going to measure to know whether you succeeded. Now, this particular step is easy until you talk about a broad workload like team sites. If you're rolling out team sites, the propensity is to say, oh, we should train users how to do everything, but don't. Pick the things that are most important to the business. And it probably is going to be something like security, maybe tagging with metadata, and then stop. Don't teach them how to do check-in and check-out unless it's critical. Don't teach them how to do approval unless it's critical. Don't teach them how to add columns to lists and how to create new workflows. Just focus on what you really need them to do to succeed, and then equip them to learn what else is possible. So in other words, this is the on-demand side. Make sure you've got content, whether it's video or written content or both, where users can say, I'd really like to do this, and IT can say, hey, go to this site, and we've got a document and a little video clip on how you can create that workflow. So your training communication should be very, very focused, because users, first of all, often don't care, and second of all, don't have long attention spans. So help them get what they want done, which is they want to get their job done, and help them do that. After the change, it's out, and we're now managing it. And we've got the last couple of steps in operations. You have to improve the operations side of SharePoint. This can be a whole 90-minute discussion as well, but it boils down to know your procedures, document them. What does it take to create a new site? What does it take to add a new web app? What do you have to do with your databases to keep them backed up? Document them, and preferably measure them. Get a feeling for what they're costing you as you move forward. Even just a rough guess. Backing up the databases takes X hours a week of our administrator time. With that, you can then automate the procedures that are costing you the most money. There's out-of-box tools, PowerShell, and there are certainly a lot of third-party tools that will help you automate the management of SharePoint. And they suddenly become a very easy discussion if you have measured your cost. Because I can tell you, ROI discussions with tools that I'm familiar with, for example, are really a no-brainer. It's just an issue of time. And if you're going to use out-of-box tools, here's another video link for you. This is a really cool presentation that I've only done once, and it turned out really well, which is about how to use PowerShell to automate the operations of SharePoint, where you can literally have a user say, I want a site, they fill in some data on a SharePoint list, and then PowerShell kicks off and creates it for them while enforcing your governance policies, setting the right permissions, turning on and off the right switches. Really neat little session about what you can do with PowerShell. But I can guarantee you, as you mature with this, at least with this current version of SharePoint, you're going to need to look at third-party tools at some point to really automate operations. And finally, in the operations section, you have to manage the portfolio. This is one of the main pieces I find missing in organizations. They will develop something in SharePoint, they'll push it out, and then they'll forget about it. They'll just let it be. And that is the kiss of death in SharePoint. Because whatever your environment is today, you must have very well managed, because tomorrow you're going to be adding something new into it. And the next month, you're going to be adding something new into it. You've got to know what you've got in place. Because if, for example, your current farm was set up to support certain things with 95% uptime, and someone comes to you with something that requires 99% uptime, you've got to know your current farm well enough to say, we can't support 99% unless we spend X dollars re-architecting it to make it work, or we can save some money by putting this new workload in its own farm, and in our giant portfolio of SharePoint service, that will actually be more efficient, more manageable, and save money. So you've got to manage your portfolio. How do you do that? You have to know what solutions you've deployed. What have you put into your environment? What were the original inputs and the design specifications for those? So in other words, this whole thing, you should have it documented. Now don't panic, because I know all of us have existing environments that are chaos. We'll talk about that later if we've got some time. But certainly moving forward, you've got to start documenting this stuff. So you create a catalog of what you've got in your environment, what were the specifications, what are the policies associated with those things, and what changes have been made over time, critical changes. Then you monitor, you watch it, and you start looking at what is the current state, what is happening today, what is the usage, what is the performance, and then you have to go back and evaluate it against what you originally thought and say, does the current state match the specifications? Because you have to ask, are you doing one of two things? Are you missing the mark? Are users not adopting it the way we thought? Are they not using it the way we thought? Are they doing something different? Is it not performing well? What happened? Why? That's a pretty obvious thing a lot of us can feel. The other thing that I see happen pretty regularly is you're a victim of your own success. Good example. Dutch governmental organization. They rolled out a document management system that was designed to host 300 gigabytes of data for a couple of hundred users. A year later, terabytes of data for 8,000 users. And they're wondering why it's slow? Shouldn't they have been watching it along the way and saying, oh my gosh, we just went to 400 gigabytes and 600 users. That's double what we expected. You need to be able to evaluate and say, oh, wow, something's wrong here, because you've got to identify a trigger that says, oops, we're either a victim of our own success or we're not achieving our mark. And then you go back into that original green and yellow box and re-architect it and refigure out what needs to be done and what it's going to take to make it work the way it needs to. And you've got to be doing that with each of the solutions. It's hard, but it's a lot easier if you know what you've got and you start inventorying those things. So managing the portfolio is hugely, hugely important, because you can't add new things into your service confidently if you don't know what the service was designed to do currently and what it's able to do currently. Now, the last step, the 12th step, commit to evolve. You'll notice this diagram of project definition, define, design, develop, deploy, isn't a cycle. It's missing a step. And that step is, we're going to do it again. We're going to close that loop. So let's break apart that diagram, and let's add the portfolio management piece, which is after you've deployed something, you're going to manage it, monitor it, and, measure it, and if you need to, you're going to modify it, which takes you right back to figuring out why it's the way it is now, what are the real project definitions, and what do we need to do to update it. And that is the end-to-end cycle. That's not just end-to-end, it's end-to-end, it keeps rolling right along. So, you've got this cycle. You've got a business with strategic management that is trying to maximize value while maintaining manageability. Strategy will define a direction for how to do that, how to maximize value. And within that strategy, there'll be steps you have to take. There'll be objectives. And some of those objectives SharePoint can support. So if SharePoint can support it, you have project management, change management, which is user-focused, operations management, which is IT-focused, that get that engine rolling and kick off that project to meet that objective. And then the next objective is addressed. And the next objective is addressed. And each time you go through the cycle, you learn. You say, oh, we didn't do that quite well. Let's do it better next time. And you recycle that learning into the system so you actually improve your ability to deliver value and increase manageability at the same time. That is the Holy Grail. And it is possible. It is absolutely possible. I can see it done in the real world. So that commit to evolve step is actually a strategic step. The organization has to be committed to evolving at the strategic level and inculcate that into the organization, which then closes the loop in full. So, in sum, we started off with this definition that governance from the web, which is governance defines processes, people, policies, and technologies that deliver a service. I had a little revelation on the airplane yesterday. I always try to think about language, because I think if we can all talk the same language and we're all on the same page, we often can move forward faster. And I realized yesterday the problem with this definition, I think, is the word deliver. Because a lot of people look at that word and say that governance is about how we create a new team site in our current collaboration environment. That's not about delivering a service. That is about managing an existing service. So if you think about the word deliver as in terms of what it is currently delivering, that's really management. In my opinion, governance is about delivering a new or slightly changed service. It's deliver in the future tense. It's the tense of that word deliver that actually I think is a huge problem. And so going back to my definition, governance defines how business needs are delivered and managed. We can now flesh that out a little bit. Governance actually is a dynamic thing. It doesn't just define how it is now. Governance defines how the service defines how business needs are delivered and managed. And each time we're going through that cycle, we're getting better at it. And governance is defining how we take that knowledge and incorporate it into the next time around. Or, a slight pivot, governance defines how a service is managed today and how that service is evolved to deliver the next business need. So take those definitions back, take the 12 steps, and figure out which ones you're strong at, which ones you're weak at. Because if you're feeling pain, it's one of those things that just needs some tweaking. Some of them are easy, some of them are hard. And as a whole, none of this is really easy. We're being put into a new world. But when you get through that program, you're going to have a whole new IT organization. You're going to, and a whole new business, in fact. You'll now be able to really say we are agile. Because if you implement SharePoint with governance correctly, SharePoint becomes agile. It drives the way IT thinks about delivering services. It moves you into the app model, the cloud model, the consumerization of IT model, and it really creates an agile organization. I hope you enjoy the rest of this track. We've got a lot on the SharePoint server track and in the project and SharePoint Better Together track. I've got a ton of resources, or Microsoft has a ton of resources for you. They're in all the slide decks. And in my slide deck, I will also have some resources in just a second. Don't forget, you have a chance to win lots of cool prizes if you submit your evals. I, in my slide deck, will finish off with an ahuiho, which is Hawaiian for till next time, a bunch of links to resources that are there for you, and a huge mahalo. Thank you guys for coming. I will be down at our booth, 1707, to answer questions after this session. Please come down and visit and say hi. If you can't hit me then, I'll be doing a book signing at the O'Reilly booth, booth 1906. And again, if you like the session, if you have feedback, please do submit an eval. They're hugely important to us. I hope this session has hit the mark for you. Thank you guys so much for coming. Enjoy TechEd.